But I think for the time being, deep learning is going to be helping out neuroscience. And I think in the long run, especially with questions, for example, of flexibility of human cognition, that's pretty much wide open.
This is Brain Inspired.
Welcome. I'm your host, Paul Nittlebrooks. So we have a few shows under our belts now, and I'm having fun doing the show. But it's time to ask you for a favor. I want to hear from you. I want to make this show as good as it can be for you, and you can help me achieve that. So I'm aware the show might be too technical for some of you, or maybe we use too much jargon, or maybe not. My point is, I'm still learning about you guys and what you like, and I won't know unless you let me know how I'm doing, how the show could be better, maybe a topic you'd like me to cover. Heck, if you have a burning question you'd like me to ask a guest, or maybe one that I could possibly answer on the show myself, send it my way. If you follow me on Twitter, I'm going to start announcing who I've scheduled to interview, so you may be able to ask a question specifically for my guest. I don't know yet how that'll work, but I'm willing to give it a go. So if you want to be a part of the conversation, connect with me on Twitter at PGMid, or you can send me an email to paul@braininspired.co. All right, enough about me needing things from you. Today, I bring you David Cicillo. David works in the Google AI Research Group at Google Brain, and he's an expert using recurrent neural networks and dynamical systems theory to model and study brains and the behaviors that come from those brains. Whew, that was already a mouthful. We do define all of that in the show, and I found David did an excellent job describing and defining as we went along, but I think it's worth breaking it down here at the outset in case you aren't familiar. A recurrent neural network is a machine learning tool, a model, that processes sequences of inputs. So you input some signal, like a sequence of words, or in our case, maybe a signal that emulates the firing rate activity of neurons. And that input then gets passed to a mass of units, many or all of which are connected to each other and therefore interacting with each other over weighted connections and changing each other's activity. And over time, this mass of units processes and spits out answers to the inputs. And like other supervised machine learning systems, recurrent neural networks are trained over time to spit out the correct answers. Okay, so that's recurrent neural network. One other thing to prime you on is dynamical systems theory, because we mentioned dynamics a lot. A dynamical system consists of two ingredients. One, you have a set of variables that describe the state of the dynamical system. In our case, say the firing rates of neurons or the activation of the units in a neural network. And the second ingredient, you have a law that describes the evolution of those state variables over time. And that's it. Things get complicated and jargony after that, and chaotic sometimes. But that's the base description of what a dynamical system is. So a recurrent neural network is a dynamical system, and a brain is a dynamical system. In both cases, their state in any moment depends on the input into them and their internal state while the input is coming in. Okay, I hope that wasn't too much. And again, we do talk about it all in the show, but I thought a primer hopefully will be helpful. Time for you to enjoy David's recurrent brain. All show notes, as usual, are online at braininspired.co. David Cicillo, welcome and thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Good to be here.
So I will have introduced you more thoroughly at the beginning and given some more details about your background, but you recently had yourself a bit of a Twitter rant, or maybe a Twitter series, if maybe that's a better way to say it. I want to read the last tweet from it.
Sure.
Quote, "In summary, systems neuroscience is about to get bonkers. the advent of inexpensive, high-quality recording equipment with the maturation of deep learning is an incredible opportunity. Couldn't be a better time to be in the field. But we should be preparing now. So David, can you tell us briefly, how do you describe what you do and what is it that we should be preparing for?
Oh yeah, sure. So I think about how recurrent neural network models and deep learning models more broadly can inform neuroscience. So in order to understand that, you have to think back to sort of traditional ways of understanding neuroscientific data. In particular, one would take a measurement from the brain, usually a single unit measurement. Nowadays, it's a population measurement, if you're lucky. And then you go and you correlate that with behavior. And maybe you say something about that. And here's how this circuit or area represents this particular portion of a behavior or computation. So now you think about, try to build a model of the measurements that were taken and how the neural measurements were taken, and figure out how would you build a model to generate a behavior such as an arm movement or a saccade in the face of some noisy decision sensory input. And you would start to scratch your head. And so for quite some time, people were building these models by hand, right? And what I started thinking about doing is using optimization to build those models. And so that's sort of what I do, is think about how to build models that can then be reverse engineered and compared to neural data. So when I had that tweet storm, what I was thinking about was a sort of confluence of two things that are happening right now. One is the advent of this inexpensive, hopefully easily available recording technology called NeuroPixels. And the other is sort of deep learning as a mature framework for handling high dimensional, large volume time series data. And the thinking is basically, if you imagined that every single systems neuroscience laboratory had access to, let's say, 10,000 simultaneously recorded neurons, what would they do with it? Right? I mean, it's a serious question. Yep. What would you even do? And so the old answer is throw away all the units except one and do what you used to do. And I don't really think that's I don't think that's the way forward. And so I just was thinking about what might need to happen. And basically, I'm a proponent of the idea that deep learning, now as a catchphrase for innovative neural network architectures and the software and hardware that powers those neural network architectures, mm-hmm. I'm an advocate of the idea that that framework will be a means to at least approach the question that systems neuroscience is interested in particular, how do populations of neurons give rise to the computations that lead to behavior?
So I'll just add that you have also been quite prolific in publishing high impact papers really at an enviable rate. So congrats on your publication success as well.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so this thinking really has led to a lot of success for you. So that was a really good introduction, and we're going to talk more about recurrent neural networks here and dive a little bit deeper into them, and that's kind of your history, part of your history. And then we'll climax, hopefully, with your latest work called LFADS, which we'll get to. Before all of that, before I pelt you with a few more bigger picture questions, okay? So,
sure.
So let's just rewind for 1 second here. So I'm John Hopfield. It's 1982, and I'm sitting at my Apple II computer, or whatever computers were used then. And I've just published my work on what will later be known as a Hopfield network that will then go on to develop into our modern fancy recurrent neural networks, or we'll probably call them RNNs from here on out. So I'm pondering the future of my little RNN. What would I imagine? Would I be happy with RNNs today? I mean, I realize I could still ask him, but I have you here, so I'm asking you.
Yeah, well, I won't presume to speak for John Hopfield, but I'll give you my own opinions.
There you go.
The Hopfield network was a massive innovation and had a profound impact on the field and sort of started, if you will, a computational or theoretical neuroscience. And it was really one of the first models, at least that I'm aware of, that required the interaction of small parts, in other words, abstract neuron units, in order to give rise to the behavior of, or the computation of that network, which is essentially associative memory, right? Mm-hmm. So those networks are good at doing gradient descent down these landscapes to find attractor states. And there's a whole theory, and quite a large theory, in fact, about how those networks work. But what they don't have, at least not in this, in the common versions, are dynamics that aren't sort of simple gradient descent dynamics. And so that's where the sort of modern RNN framework comes in, where you have a universal function approximator, and universal in the sense that any dynamical system can be arbitrarily approximated by a recurrent neural network.
If it's large enough, right?
Sure, if it, under lots of constraints, most right. of which I'm not going to remember here. but the idea is that it's an extremely generic device for generating dynamics. And so if you believe that dynamics can subserve computation and behavior, then it's a really interesting tool to study, not the least of which is because brains, biological brains, are massively recurrently connected, both locally, top down, and so on. And so it's just a very natural fit or tool to try to make sense of neural computation.
Right. So just to step back a little bit, so an RNN is an artificial recurrent neural network. So meaning its units get feedback over time from other units, just like you said, like the brain is wired up.
That's right.
At a really high level, do you want to just briefly describe more deeply what an RNN is and maybe how it compares to the better known, what I think of as deep learning, which is the feed forward type of network?
Oh, yeah, sure. So in all of these frameworks, what you have are artificial neurons or units, and they take in a weighted sum of inputs, and you put it through some sort of nonlinearity, like a sigmoid or some kind of threshold, and that's the output of that unit. And that's a pretty simple device, a single neuron or unit. I sort of think of neuron useful as biological neurons and say units for artificial networks, just so I don't get the...
I agree, and it makes me a little itchy when people call them neurons.
Yeah, totally. So then you take these units and you interconnect them, and that's really where the magic is. It's the magic of connectionism, right? So the weights, the synapses, if you will, are adjusted, and when you connect them just so, you can develop, you can create these artificial networks that have incredibly complex behavior, high-dimensional behavior. So the difference between a recurrent neural network and a feed-forward network, which is also called a deep network, is that in deep networks, you have an input, which is, for example, an image relayed through a series of layers, which are all computing these functions, and then leads to an output. And in the recurrent case, however, one thinks of, for example, a time series where you put an input in at the first time step or even at every time step, and that system sort of continues to compute over those inputs and using its own hidden state. And so it's recurrent in the sense of reverberation, in the sense that the state of that network affects the future state.
That's a great description. Thank you for that. One could say that RNNs, so deep learning is kind of ahead of recurrent neural networks, or feed-forward networks are kind of ahead in popularity with respect to RNNs. But RNNs are gaining a lot of ground, and they're back, and they're great for neuroscience research. There are lots of reasons for that, one of which you mentioned, they're modeled a lot like brains are modeled, in that there's a lot of feedback connections with the recurrent units. So are there other reasons why RNNs are useful for neuroscience research?
That's basically the reason.
Yeah, you also mentioned at the top that people are recording from tons of units these days, and it's requiring new methods to keep up with this deluge of data, as you've said.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So just to add a little bit to this, there are places in, for example, in the visual cortex where feed-forward networks are being used quite heavily to study what is thought to be a largely feed-forward process of, for example, object classification. I'm thinking, when I think about recurrent networks, RNNs, more in terms of downstream brain areas, motor cortex, executive cortex, surely any of the subcortical structures that are relaying information here, there, and everywhere. And so I sort of think of the recurrent network as being a little more general and more useful. But that's just my own bias.
You'd mentioned, you know, RNNs differ from traditional modeling in the past in neuroscience. One of the reasons is because an RNN system, as you've written, gets told what to optimize, but not how to optimize it, where in traditional neuroscience models, a lot of the stuff is hand-tweaked to, and so the models are essentially taught how to process the information and compute the information. And an RNN does it all for you because you just train it on gradient descent or other methods, of course. So it's really a new and really expanding field of research from which you have done a lot of the pioneering work in. So do you think that RNNs could be useful as a mechanistic account or of the brain, or are they more useful as like a hypothesis generator about how the brain works, or a description of brain processes?
Right. It's a really interesting question, and it's actually a question I've been giving quite a lot of thought to. So it depends on what you mean by mechanistic. And here we should take a brief minute to talk about real biological neurons and how they're connected and so forth. So real biological neurons communicate with action potentials. They are extremely complicated. They have obviously a three-dimensional volume, dendrites and axons and apical dendrites and basal dendrites. And I'm just painting out some of the picture of the complexity of these units. So, if one wanted to understand how those were wired up in a very particular way that gave credence to the richness of the biological circuits with interneurons and so forth, then I don't believe that artificial networks as they're being used right now are going to be helpful for that endeavor. That is to say, if you were on the hunt for the mythical cortical microcircuit, right, I don't know if artificial networks are going to help you. However, if you assert an abstraction, which is that you know that there's this extremely complex biological layer, but you're not going to touch it. You're just going to assume that there are these neurons or even collections of neurons, weighted sums of real neurons that act as if they were an artificial unit in an artificial neural network. Then you can sort of think of these factors or population activity that are arising in this biological complex circuit. You can think of those factors as being generated from recurrent neural networks. And so if you're willing to work on that level of abstraction, then you can think about the word mechanism. It's just sort of at a higher level. And you could ask yourself, what connections between these abstract factors, temporal factors, you know, wiggles through time. This one wiggles a certain way, another factor wiggles another way. How should those be connected so as to give rise to some dynamic? And it's in that sense that I think of using recurrent neural networks, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about dynamics in just a second, actually. So a lot of your work with RNNs has dealt with encoding movement initiation. But of course, the brain does a lot more than encode movements. And you mentioned just a minute ago that people use feedforward networks to model early visual cortex or early sensory areas. And then you mentioned that RNNs are probably good for subcortical processes and these movement initiation processes. But so the brain, there's an N with the senses, and there's an out with the movements, right? And then all the stuff in between, which is thought and encoding the sense, the sensation and the movements. So is that how you generally think of them, as movement initiation encoders and subcortical processes, or do you see them more as general purpose circuits that could model most brain processing should they want to, should one want to?
Oh, definitely the latter. I think of RNNs as being quite generic. And so it's the most natural, in fact, if you will, to think of the generation of muscle patterns. You lift your arm or you move it sideways or so on. You pick up a cup of coffee. That is obviously a set of patterns through time to run those muscles in those different ways, using different loads that you're carrying, etc. So it's pretty clear that motor cortex has to generate dynamical patterns, and therefore an RNN is very obvious there. However, when you look at, when you just study, examine cortical patterns in many regions, you see just an enormous amount of dynamics that can be correlated to behavior. And so you know that dynamical patterns, it's at least a reasonable guess that dynamical patterns are subserving the computations in other regions as well. For example, when you make a decision to get a Diet Coke or have an ice cream, I'm sure that those patterns are dynamical. And so it would be very natural to use RNNs to model those. And it gets to the idea which my colleagues have been calling computation through dynamics. We used to call it the dynamical systems hypothesis. But now I like the phrase computation through dynamics. And that's the idea that computation is a set of dynamical patterns, if you will, in some high-dimensional state space. And what is interesting is that these networks can sort of be flexibly reconfigured to have different dynamics under different behavioral contingencies, and therefore flexibly subserve different behaviors.
So you keep using the term dynamics, which let's just then jump into dynamical systems theory a little bit and how it relates. So people have been skeptical that historically that using RNNs or other neural nets to study the brain isn't useful because we haven't been able to see inside the RNN to see what's happening, how it's computing things. So the argument, as I understand it, is that we won't be any closer to understanding brains if we don't understand the thing that we use to study brains. So a lot of great work that you've done, and again, I'll say pioneered, is using dynamical systems theory to do just that, to study what's happening in RNNs, your computation through dynamics. So you and others have used the dynamical systems theory framework to study populations of neurons in the brain as well. So how and why is dynamical systems theory a useful tool to open up the black box of RNNs and study the brain?
Sure. So if you believe that you have recurrent connectivity that's meaningful behaviorally, then you're sort of forced into the framework of dynamics. And that is to say, just think of a pendulum, right? You have an initial condition. In the case of a pendulum, you set it up to some height above its resting state and you let it go. And you can just watch that pendulum sort of swing back to the bottom and assuming there's friction, come to a stop at the bottom. That's a dynamic. The pendulum is a simple dynamical system. And it's really a very simple, at least in the metaphor, what we're talking about. And so you're sort of forced into that framework. And what makes things complicated is the fact that the dynamics are nonlinear. But even there, there's a modicum of hope in that one can describe nonlinear dynamics if you're careful using linearization approaches. And so that's what we did. Basically, I took a couple of nonlinear dynamical systems classes. You learn about all these techniques, and mathematicians, of course, love to prove things. So a lot of the examples in that field are two and three dimensional, where you have a chance of actually proving something, right? And what we did is we just applied these textbook ideas to 1,000 dimensional systems, just to see what would happen. And at least if that system is simple, not too complicated, These are moderate success. This is not a home run, not yet. I haven't figured that out yet. Then you can actually reverse engineer or open up the black box of a trained recurrent neural network. You can do it. And we did it for example, like a 3-bit memory device or a sine wave generator, some of these paradigmatic but still simple type of circuits. And so dynamical systems, just to summarize, is forced upon you by virtue of recurrent connections. And then you begin to see the language as being useful when studying neural circuits.
So it seems like, so first of all, I should just state that dynamical systems are systems that have very few properties. They're simple overall, their overall setup. So you're measuring something through time. What am I missing? the definition of a dynamical system.
Yeah, it would be x dot, the derivative of x is equal to f of x.
Right. Yeah.
So then it gets a little more complicated if you allow the function f to have an input as well.
Right.
And so, but that's, I mean, it's in it, at that level that you just described, it is not even particularly meaningful. You have to sort of pin it down and say things like, I believe that the neural population state as measured, say, by binned action potentials across a population of neurons, I believe that that is the state to a dynamical system. And that then sort of, if that hypothesis imposes some structure on the problem, for example, you don't cross paths in the high dimensional state space as the trajectories, unless there's an input, as the trajectories move around and so forth.
And when you, just to be clear, when you say a trajectory in a state space, all that means is that, let's say you're recording from 3 neurons, then your state space could be the activity of those neurons. And so the trajectory is the way that let's say the firing rates of those neurons through time will draw out a trajectory in a 3-dimensional state space if you're recording from 3 neurons, for example, correct?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, good. So, like I said, RNNs are back in a big way. They, to my estimation, they fell behind deep learning feedforward networks, partly because they're so tricky to train. So there's a quote from a recent paper that you published studying the capacity and the trainability in RNNs. Quote, despite these recent successes, it is widely acknowledged that designing and training the RNN components in complex models can be extremely tricky. Painfully acquired RNN expertise is still crucial to the success of most projects. David, I appreciate your pain here. So why why is training them so tricky and painful?
Yes, so there is, it's because of the recurrent connections. So intuitively, if you iterate a process over and over and over again, then unless that system is just very precisely configured, if you iterate, say, x times 0.9 times 0.9 times 0.9 times 0.9, you eventually go to zero. And if you did x times 1.1 times 1.1 times 1.1, you eventually go to infinity. Mm-hmm. And so this is getting at this problem that we call vanishing or exploding gradients. And it just turns out that using gradient descent, so you set up input and outputs to create a task, for example, drive this arm with these input conditions, and you set that up with a loss function, and you try to do gradient descent on that loss function to make the recurrent neural network train, you just discover that your gradients are completely bonkers, to use that word again. In this case, it may not train at all. The other problem is that these dynamical systems can have chaotic behavior. So tiny, tiny changes in the initial state of the system can lead to dramatically different outcomes. And that's chaos and computation do not mix. It's oil and water. And so that chaos is actually expressed in the same gradient problem of an exploding gradient, because a tiny change will lead to massively different outcomes. Well, then when you take the gradient of that, it's enormous.
Yeah, and you and your colleagues have figured out ways to tame that chaos and actually train the RNNs so that they are extremely powerful computing networks, and you can reproduce signals from the brain with super high accuracy. It's really impressive. So in that same paper, so you were testing how much memory and information that RNNs can hang on to, essentially. And you tested some known RNNs, and you guys innovated some of your own as well to test.
That's right.
I think I know the answer to this based on your earlier comments, but are the RNNs that you innovated, are they more or less neurally plausible than the known RNNs that you tested? And does that even matter?
Yeah, the answer is who knows. You sort of glance at some of these things after working in the field for a while and you get some ideas. And so that was that case. I think if you wanted to make RNNs that were more similar to neural circuits, you sort of have two approaches. One is a functional approach and just figure out ways that the actual data recorded from biological brains and data generated from artificial neural networks, you might think about how that should look more and more similar. You could also just study the architecture, the connectomics of biological circuits, and use that as well. But of course, lurking in this entire discussion is the question of action potentials and discrete signals being passed in biological brains. Most of artificial neural networks is done using what are called end-to-end differentiable models, where you take a gradient of the loss and you can propagate that all the way to the input if you wanted to. In the brain, it's not at all clear that there's such a thing as backpropagation. And so there's this, in the question of neural network architecture and its similarity to biological circuits, there's this enormous looming problem that it's a very long stretch to believe that backpropagation is working in biological circuits.
I have a few people on my list that I hope to talk to about that very topic. Hopefully I can devote an entire episode to it. We'll see. But
very good. I'll leave it alone then.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We could go pretty deep on it. Well, do you think that we're still in the early stages of optimizing RNNs as tools, or is the future really wide open?
I think that, I definitely think we're in the early stages, and I do think we're also, the future is wide open.
Right. That's the same thing, actually. Yeah.
I think that I don't really know what other frameworks are going to help neuroscientists when they start generating enormous data sets, and they already are, for that matter.
Well, okay. Let's just end it there, because that's a great segue into your most recent work. So what we've been talking about so far, so that was how you got to the present, to what you're doing in the present. And speaking of high-impact papers, it seems like a good time to talk about something that you're really excited about now, something called LFADs, from a paper that you've really recently, actually currently have in press at Nature Methods. So congratulations again.
Thank you.
So I actually, in preparing for this interview, I watched your talk online. It was a talk you gave at Stanford about LFADs. And I was at a bar at a hotel in Denver. Don't ask. My children needed to go to sleep. I was actually at a bar, quiet bar at the hotel, and I was laughing out loud watching your talk. So people probably didn't suspect that I was watching a science talk. But I was laughing because you could barely get through the talk. And I was remembering my own experiences like that. So the audience was so skeptical, and they kept interjecting and then started discussing amongst themselves, and you could hardly get a word in. And it's been a little over a year since I've been in academia, and I just remember those experiences. It was funny to be, first of all, to be laughing out loud, but then secondly, to wonder what the hell people thought I was laughing at. But so I think that means you're doing something really cool, right? I think, right?
I hope so.
Sure. So by way of a super short introduction to LFADs, it's a system that connects together at least three RNNs, so three of these systems that we've already been talking about, in a series of computational steps, and along with other interspersed layers of computations and transformations. So it does this to infer the dynamics happening on single trials over a medium to large population of neurons. What else do we need to know about LFADs and about what LFADs does and how it works?
Yeah, sure. So to couch the conversation in the broadest terms, we spent a good portion of this interview talking about what I call model the task. That is, use RNNs to model a behavior. And then when you have that trained RNN model. If it does the behavior that you're interested in, you can sample the RNN. You can record from a biological circuit that you believe subserves that same behavior in an animal, and you can compare the two. And if the comparison of the neural data and the internals of the artificial network are similar, then it gives you justification to attempt to reverse engineer the artificial network in order to understand what it's doing, to make hypotheses about what the biological network is doing.
Right.
So that's the model, the task framework. LFADS is in the model the data framework. It's a really much more simple concept, actually, which is you have these high-dimensional action potential, these spike trains, and you would just like to build a system that can spit them out. And the idea there is that by doing that, again, you have a system now that can generate the data that you're interested in. And so you could, if you had the wit, understand that artificial system. And so in particular, the way to think about LFADS is in the tradition of an autoencoder. An autoencoder is you take, for example, an image and you push it through, say, a feed-forward network to through some hidden layers that have, say, a restriction on the number of hidden units or some other restriction such that they encode the data more intuitively. And then you try to regenerate that same image, right? And that's called an autoencoder. And LFADS is basically a sequential autoencoder. It takes time series and it encodes them into an initial condition and also some inferred inputs, which I'll leave alone for now. But it takes a time series and it infers it in an initial condition such that that initial condition, when put through an RNN, which is a dynamical system, regenerates your data. So it's a really enormous bottleneck on high-dimensional time series. And the idea is when you train an LFADS system on your high-dimensional neural data, you get a set of representations for your data that are extremely informative, that are potentially much more informative than standard PSTH, paired stimulus time histogram. And so you get very clean rates on single trials. You get a set of factors that are sort of like PCA factors that a systems neuroscientist might use, mm-hmm. a set of initial conditions and so forth. And the goal then is that on single trials, you begin to see the dynamical structure of your data in ways that you hadn't seen it before.
Why do you think they're giving you such a hard time during that talk?
Well, in that case,
I should say there was a lot of excitement also in the room, but there was a lot of doubters and a lot of conversation going on.
I really don't know the answer to that question. Some scientists are just inherently skeptical. For my part, I've seen the perspective of deep learning be applied many times in a useful and fruitful way in neuroscience, but it's a new idea, and there's always going to be resistance to new ideas. And I guess also I should say I personally didn't find that audience to be aggressive. I just found them to be really extremely curious, shall we say.
Yeah, they were really active. I mean, it reminds me of the brown bags and things like that, that where you're or like a lab meeting where you're presenting in front of your colleagues, you know. So, but one of the women, I don't know who it was, asked, one of her objections was that, so science is supposed to become more simple, not more complex, and the LFADS system seems to add complexity in as an with explanatory power. And so she didn't like that. My thought was that, well, of course, you have to get more complex before you really can get simpler. So it's part of the framework of how to even approach these things, which we all have to figure out. It's going to get complex. So my
take on this is that I think of that as a legitimate
Me too.
Concern.
Me too.
And I would respond that these deep networks, for the sake of scientific exploration, this isn't just neuroscience, by the way. I mean, I can see RNNs and artificial networks generally being useful in enormous numbers of science because it's automated hypothesis generation.
Right.
But for someone like me who's a proponent of this, it's on us. The onus is on us to find ways to reverse engineer these artificial systems. And I guess what I would say is we've made some very preliminary steps in that direction. And, it's still early days. And so we should, I think, be given a wide leash for a while. The other thing I would say is that, in particular for ALFADS, which is explicitly geared towards neural data, you can still have a sophisticated neural architecture where it's carved up at the joints precisely so that it exposes representations of your data that are hopefully more meaningful to you, even though you don't understand the complete architecture of how you got there. Right. In some sense, it's a tool.
That's good. So my last question here about LFADs and RNNs in general, and then I know you have to go soon, so I hope we have time for some general questions. But so RNNs and LFADs use firing rates, not action potentials. I know that they recreate action potentials, LFADs does. But so there's been a lot of more work on spiking recurring neural networks that can take in spikes instead of the firing rates, which is what that brain actually uses. So does LFADs make it less important to figure out how to make the spiking recurrent neural networks work well?
No, I don't think so. I think that spiking neural networks is a very important topic. It's just extremely difficult because you sort of leave the world of gradients. So I think that's an important but separate field. There's I wouldn't say a broad consensus. There is some consensus that the brain is representing the world in sort of continuous quantities. But I guess that might be somewhat controversial. That's how I think of it. I mean, the workaday experimental neuroscientists, the first thing they do is take a bunch of measurements and then trial average. And then now from that trial average, you get a continuous smooth PSDH and you correlate that with behavior. So at the very least, smooth, continuous representations of neural spiking data have been and can be correlated to behavior and computation for quite some time now.
Right. Very good. Okay. Are you ready to speculate for the next 2 minutes?
Yeah, sure. We have a few minutes.
Well, you cut me off then, okay?
Okay, sure.
What's something that we'll learn about the brain and or mind because of AI?
I think that for the time being, there's a broad question here, which you may ultimately get to, but I'm just going to answer it now. There's interaction between neuroscience and AI, and I think that right now AI is very much going to be contributing to help neuroscience. Of course, deep learning is founded on basic architectural observations of the brain. Convolutional networks are clearly inspired by the visual cortex, recurrency, simple units being connected together. That's all based on looking at actual brains. But I think for the time being, deep learning is going to be helping out neuroscience. And I think in the long run, especially with questions, for example, of flexibility of human cognition, that's pretty much wide open, right? Deep learning networks are fabulous experts, but not very good at all at generalization. And so I think in the long run, biological networks and neuroscience will help us understand those issues.
So do you think that neuroscience and AI are converging or diverging?
I would say both, and I don't think that answers a hedge. What's happening is that AI is growing into a very large field, and there are people who have strong opinions both that neuroscience is absolutely mandatory for understanding artificial intelligence, and there are people who think that it's a complete waste of time. And the field is large enough that I think there's room for both of those perspectives.
That's a good answer. How important is it for a neuroscientist, do you think, to become adept in AI and vice versa?
Oh, I think it's extremely important, and I can even generalize beyond that. I think of learning deep learning and techniques and artificial intelligence techniques as programming of the 21st century. I mean, when I was at Carnegie Mellon in the early 90s, I was a computer science major. We had to learn computer science and something else. Computer science in English, computer science in psychology. Right. And I think that's going to be true for deep learning. Is just an incredibly powerful framework for handling large amounts of data. And so, the answer is yes. I think that neuroscientists should be learning deep learning.
And do you think that deep learners should be learning neuroscience? Or is that more the computer science that they should be learning something, not necessarily neuroscience?
That's right. Yes.
Okay. Okay. Two more questions. One, when will we know what we mean when we say consciousness?
No idea. I'm going to leave that one to my betters.
All right. I'll answer it after the show. Okay, last question. Oh, actually, two more questions. Number one, how can I be more like you? Okay, number two, where should I point people to follow what you're doing? Should I point people to Twitter or...
Yeah, I've been using Twitter lately to broadcast new work and to generally opine if people are interested in that kind of thing. So my Twitter account is a good place to find me.
I agree. Well, I know that you're pressed for time, that you're in an office, a meeting room that people are banging down the door to get in there. So I just want to say thank you, David, for taking the time to talk to me, and I appreciate your time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Man, I love this stuff. If you're feeling generous, please leave the show a review on iTunes. You've heard this before on every other podcast I know, but it does help. So thanks in advance for the review, and thank you for listening. See you soon.